You're listening to Season 10 of Mobile Suit Breakdown, a weekly podcast covering the entirety of sci-fi mega-franchise Mobile Suit Gundam from 1979 to today.
This is episode 10.9, The Cossarelia Stampede, and we are your hosts. I'm the ZMS09G Tomliat.
And I'm Pippi Ninaden. With apologies for my voice this week, if I sound a little hoarse, it's because I am still getting over the cold that prevented me from recording last week, but didn't want to make Tom solo a whole nother episode, so you get to hear me in all my phlegmy glory.
I think I could handle it. I could do both sides of the talkback. Just give me a list of all the things you think I'm wrong about, and I'll argue both sides.
Mobile Suit Breakdown is made possible by 740 paying subscribers. Thank you all, and special thanks to our newest patrons, Anthony G. and James M. You keep MSB Genki.
This week we're covering Victory Episode 9, Tabidachi, or Departure. This episode was written by Sonoda Hideki, storyboarded and directed by Sato Ikuro, with both Taniguchi Moriyasa and Yoshida Toru as animation directors. Key animation seems to have been outsourced to the studio Anime R, with secondary animation handled by Studio Dove.
And now the recap for Victory Gundam Episode 9, Departure.
The League Militaire convoy is heading back to Cossarelia. Uso has gone ahead in the Victory Gundam, accompanied by Odello, Warren, and Susie, riding on the outside of the mobile suit. As they pass through the ruins of what might once have been a village, a radar ping alerts Uso to Bespa forces overhead. He leaves the other kids to continue on foot, and goes ahead to scout. In the sky above Cossarelia, Chronicle Asher, accompanied by Miss Katagina Luz, leads a three-unit Zolo squadron, escorting Commander Farah Griffin's Recarl. She is headed to Gibraltar, and from there to space. She seems calm, despite knowing that, in all likelihood, she will soon meet her end beneath the guillotine. As they pass over Point Cossarelia, Katagina thanks Chronicle for taking her to see her old home, but Chronicle seems to have something besides sightseeing in mind. Remembering the humiliation he suffered in this very location, when Uso threw him from the Shako's cockpit and made off with the prototype mobile suit, Chronicle orders his wingmen to scout the region. Mere moments later, his radio crackles. They've spotted smoke rising from one of the houses. Blissfully ignorant of the approaching danger, Shakti busies herself tending to Carlman and cooking a welcome home meal for Uso. She is interrupted by the sound of beam rotors. She spots them through the window, but doesn't have time to do more than wonder what Katagina is doing there, before Chronicle bursts in, pistol in hand. Curiously, Flanders seems to recognize the young prince. Uso watches Chronicle land from a hidden vantage point in the woods, but the Gundam is spotted by the other two Zolos, and Uso is taken captive before he can board his machine. Luckily for him, the Yellowjackets assume that he's just some local kid, and that the Gundam's real pilot, a real soldier, is still missing. Uso is shocked to find Katagina here, accompanying Chronicle and the Yellowjackets of her own free will, or so it seems. When he demands an explanation, she pauses for just a moment before telling him that she has become convinced that what the old men on the Kamion are doing will doom the Earth. She has decided to attach herself to Chronicle to observe the Zanskar Empire's methods. Perhaps they can offer a way forward. Chronicle reports the successful capture of the Victory back to Commander Griffin, then decides to take it out for a test flight. Yet there's something bothering him about this Uso kid. Could there be some kind of connection between the boy and this mobile suit, with its feather-like controls tuned so precisely that even a child could operate them? He can't seem to figure it out. His wingmen stay behind to keep an eye on the captives. They amuse themselves by eating Shakti's food and even graciously offer to let Uso have some once they're finished. Suddenly, they hear Flanders barking outside. A herd of sheep runs past the window, Susie clinging to one of them. One of the Yellowjackets, Ray, rushes outside to scold the young girl for sheep rustling. Odello and Warren are lying in wait, and they clobber him the moment he falls into their trap. They try a similar trick on the second Yellow Jacket, but he easily overpowers Odello. And when Uso grabs him from behind, the soldier throws him to the ground and levels his pistol at the young boy's head. "Nobody move, or I'll blow his face off," he warns. But he is taken off guard by Susie and her stampeding sheep before he can make good on his threat. In the chaos, Uso gets free, and Odello snatches the gun. While Odello and the other kids tie up the captured Yellow Jackets, Uso boards one of the Zolos. Meanwhile, Oliver has arrived on the scene in his core fighter. Mistaking Chronicle and the stolen Victory Gundam for an ally, he only narrowly escapes destruction when Uso's Zolo arrives to block Chronicle's surprise saber attack. Both pilots struggle to control their unfamiliar machines. While Oliver does all he can to avoid long-range fire from the Recarl, Uso hides in the forest, the better to read the Zolo's manual, and Chronicle returns to the cabin to ditch the now-damaged Victory in favor of his own Zolo. Odello almost manages to shoot him while he's changing machines, but Katagina prevents it. As they grapple over the pistol, she insists that she is only helping Chronicle to preserve her cover as a spy. Odello is not impressed by this self-serving rationalization, but as soon as he shakes her off, he finds himself staring up into the barrel of the Zolo's beam rifle. He is only saved by the sudden arrival of Uso in his stolen mobile suit. He rams Chronicle, then makes a quick transfer back into the Victory in time to rescue Oliver from the Recarl. While Uso is busy, Chronicle retrieves Katagina and his captured wingmen, and they depart aboard the two surviving Zolos. Uso can't bring himself to fire on Chronicle's machine, knowing that Katagina is aboard, so he lets the Yellow Jackets withdraw. The enemy is gone, but Casarelia is no longer secret, and no longer safe. Uso tells Shakti that they need to leave. He can't bring himself to look at her. I came to her defense before, but for someone who has ostensibly spent her entire life hiding, Shakti is super bad at hiding. Concealing the fire from your cooking is hiding 101. Come on! Especially when you know that there are enemies in the area flying around in the sky.
It does seem like living in hiding was more figurative than literal for them. They have fields out in the open. Like, yes, the house is kind of under the cliff ledge, but there are rows of planted crops. It's clear somebody lives there.
The show repeatedly describes these characters as illegal residents, as squatters, and suggests that they are in hiding. Now, in the expanded materials, in the novel, which I know you don't want me to bring up, but bear with me for a second, there is an explanation for this. There is like a whole thing about how like the Earth Federation authorities who are responsible for looking for illegal residents have kind of given up that mission, either because of the generalized lethargy of Earth Federation institutions or because of a more specific feeling that like they've got pretty cushy jobs and their organization and those cushy jobs would not exist if they actually succeeded in their mission. So they have an institutional incentive to ignore most illegal residents so that the illegal residency problem continues to exist. Problem in quotation marks. And so their organization continues to get funding and permission to live on Earth and all the nice benefits of that.
So yeah, like just like the real world where undocumented immigration, everybody likes to make a big show of fighting it, but basically every place where it happens has industries that depend on it for their survival.
Right. But none of that actual explanation is in the show, and so it just makes Shakti look like she's super duper bad at hiding.
Kind of incongruous with how responsible she's generally been and the fact that this has been her life for as long as she can remember.
Totally. It's also the second time this has happened to her. You'd think she would have learned after the first time she, like, bolted out of doors and encountered a bunch of Bespa Zolos instead of Uso.
Ah, but she does recognize the sound of beam rotors now. If it's a beam rotor, it's the baddies.
But it's not like she goes and hides in the cellar or something. I mean, I don't know if that would do any good. she doesn't really have time.
So far, also, her encounters with them have mostly been frightening, but they just let her go. At this point, she may feel that young girl with a baby and a dog in a cabin in the middle of nowhere is not all that suspicious. If she tries to run, suddenly it becomes more suspicious.
That's true. Though I'm reminded of that bit in the first Men in Black movie when they're doing testing exercises for the new agents and they go into the shooting gallery and it's all of these aliens doing perfectly normal things. And then there's just like a little unaccompanied girl with a physics textbook. And that's the most suspicious thing in the whole lot. Like, actually, Shakti alone in this cabin in Casarelia, which appears to have no other residence whatsoever, with the baby, the dog, and the high-grade Haro robot, actually should be very suspicious.
I love that the high-grade Haro robot comes complete with bubble-blowing action. Because Haro likes to make babies smile, I guess. Who knew Haro was just like us?
Nina, I have a secret. I'm actually 5 Haros in a human suit.
Well, your vocabulary certainly improved.
Tragically, my ability to blow bubbles has declined.
Here's a question for you. Is Flanders, A, not a great guard dog beyond, like, the warning growls? B, Flanders remembers Chronicle from before?
It's super duper, that one.
Or C, we are meant to interpret the scene where Flanders stops growling and Chronicle pets him as like, oh, Chronicle is really a good guy because dogs can always tell if you're a good person.
You know, if they hadn't done so much work in prior episodes to set up the fact that, like, Chronicle maybe used to live here, definitely has met Shakti before, then maybe I would entertain the possibility that C is correct. But no, there was definitely a point at which Chronicle's sister, the current queen of the Zanskar Empire, was in Casarelia looking after Shakti. And Chronicle seems to have been there too. He was in that photograph.
Well, and that this woman is her literal aunt or like a very close family friend who she refers to as an auntie.
You know, we don't know who took that photo. Maybe Flanders took the photo. We know Flanders has remarkable capabilities for a dog and that those paws can do things that dog paws normally can't. If he can ride a wappa, he can take a photo.
There's also no second adult woman in that photo, so maybe Shakti's mother.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. We didn't examine this at the time, but the specific framing of that photo with Shakti sitting on the lap of Maria, Maria looking serious, Chronicle in the back kind of looming, and then in the foreground we just see like the left arm and shoulder and the back of the head of an adult man in a suit. It's kind of an ominous composition.
I didn't feel like it was ominous at all, just a little strange.
I don't know. Chronicle's body language in that shot looks tense, angry. And Maria looks real serious.
I didn't think he looked angry at all. I thought he looked like he was trying very hard to look nonchalant. Like, oh, here I'm leaning on the fireplace, looking cool in the background of this photo. It's true that she does look very serious. And it's odd to have the other person not even attempting to look towards the camera. Especially because Chronicle feels like he's posing, but then nobody else feels as though they are. Yeah, it's...
I guess, rather than angry, Chronicle looks like he's there because he's trying to, like, protect his sister or something. Like, he's not really a part of this conversation that is happening, but he feels like he needs to be there.
I guess, not that he looks it exactly, but I just interpreted that as him being a teenager at that point, because Shakti is what, 12?
11.
11, and she's maybe 2 in the photo, so this is 9 years ago, which would make Chronicle like a late teen or early 20s aged person in the photo.
There's no way he's in his 30s.
How old is he supposed to be now?
He's probably traditional Shar age, which means he's about 20.
So then he would be like, okay, then the photo is weird.
Right.
Because there's no way he looks 12.
He had a weird growth spurt.
But my point remains, I think a lot of the awkwardness of him in that photo is him as like a teen
mm-hmm.
who is awkward in this situation. Is it like a bunch of adults and a baby? Like, what does he care about any of this?
Yeah, given his like supposed age, given Shakti's apparent age in the photo, Chronicle would have been like Uso's age. Maybe a little bit older or a little bit younger, but like...
Yeah, even if we
12,
say...
13, 14. Couldn't have been older than Odello.
Wait, didn't you say Odello is older?
Odello is older than Uso. I think Odello is like 14.
Oh, that's weird too. He seems much older to me in the way that that character operates in the world.
Sorry, he's 15.
Okay.
And Chronicle is 20. Odello's age doesn't seem that weird to me because he's the oldest one in the group. He has that like oldest sibling thing where you have to act more like an adult than you actually are.
He had so many great scenes and moments in this episode. The whole plan to go help Uso, so great. That moment when after he's hit someone over the head, he accidentally smacks himself into the fence.
That feels like a pure Tomino moment. Like, I can't think of another anime director who would include that goofy little atonal bit of clumsiness.
But it is absolutely the kind of thing someone would do when they're trying to look all around them and not really watching where they're going.
Yeah, 100%. It's real, but cinematically incoherent, which is one of, I think, Tomino's characteristics as a director.
As a consummate survivor, while everyone else is worrying about, gosh, what's taking Uso so long? And gosh, what's happening? Odello is eating. He's like, oh, gotta eat while you have the opportunity. Is there food here? We better eat it.
Yep.
Who knows when we will have another chance?
Yep.
And I gotta say, I agree with him when he remarks to Katajina that if she wants their trust, she better deliver some results.
Yeah. Also love him pulling the gun on that one yellow jacket and being like, well, if I'm a sheep rustler, then you know I know how to use one of these.
I almost never want to do this, but I want to explain our title for this episode because we called it Casarelia Stampede, and the obvious interpretation is the stampede of sheep that happens a couple of times, but I was also thinking of the fact that a lot of rodeos are called such and such place stampede. And I don't know that it's super common. I bet it is. I've only been to the rodeo a couple of times when I lived in Texas. Sometimes they will have young kids basically cling to the backs of sheep like Susie is doing here. And often it'll be a competition. Whoever who can hang on the longest wins some money for their school's 4-H club or something. So obviously you're not going to put little kids on bucking broncos or on bulls, but they'll put them on the backs of sheep. So Susie is part of a long and storied tradition, is what I'm saying.
Even within this episode, Susie ramming them with the sheep is basically the same as when Uso uses the detached bottom terminal from his Zolo to ram Chronicle's mobile suit.
Though she doesn't really have control,
mm-hmm.
especially on that second pass.
Do any of us really have control? Surely, are we not all clinging to the back of the sheep of life?
Another small detail, but the show absolutely does not want us to forget that Susie is traumatized when the group of kids leave the cabin and go hide in the woods. Susie is curled into a ball on the ground with her hands over her ears. Everyone else is trying to figure out, huh, I don't recognize the sound of those rotors, or I don't recognize the sound of that weapon, like... what's happening? Can we see who's flying what or where? Susie is just curled up, hands over her ears, trying not to hear it.
Poor kid.
Why do soldiers care about sheep rustling anyway? They're here eating other people's food, making themselves at home in someone else's house, lounging around while these kids are freaking out. Clear flashbacks to First Gundam, by the way.
When the Federation soldiers bust into Amuro's place and
right, well, when he
drink all the booze. And...
when he returns to his home to find it full of carousing soldiers mm-hmm. and no sign of his mother.
Yeah. I think it's there for the irony. I think it's there so that this guy, I think Ray is his name, can burst out of the door and with other people's food spraying forth from his mouth, shout, hey, stealing is bad!
And I don't know what those kids plan to do about the sheep, but I guess they should probably just let them out. Then the sheep can forage for themselves. That might give them their best shot.
I guess that turns on whether or not there are actually other people living in Casarelia. We haven't seen them since the first episode, but like, in theory, this is a village, there are other people who might look after those sheep. There's a lot of that Double Zeta-esque slapstick in this, a lot of, falling out of cockpits and cockpit doors getting damaged. And
Tomino animals, so many Tomino animals.
Love the parade of chickens at the beginning. When Uso first stops the Victory, and he stops quite suddenly, and the kids who are riding on the raised skirt, which is a neat little detail that he can make a little, like, platform with the Victory's armored skirts, they all get thrown off of it. And when Odello drops Susie into the waiting palm of the Victory, it's, like, not as close as you would think it should be. She falls a considerable distance and lands, like, on her neck. And then we don't see her move for, like, 9 minutes after that in the show. Part of me was like, wait, is Susie okay?
I do like that scene. It is far, though she tells Odello, go ahead, drop me. And the hand has to be adjusted, actually, to catch her, because she's not as centered over it as maybe she thought she was. That moment, Uso kind of forgetting that he has passengers, feels like the first in a whole series of moments over the course of this episode that remind us of Uso's inexperience and that he's a kid put into an adult situation. And a lot of this is things he does or doesn't do. Things like being caught unawares while he's spying on Chronicle, not being able to get back to his cockpit in time.
Well, we talked about irony earlier. Now, when Uso is actually committed to being the Victory's pilot, nobody believes it. The Yellow Jackets see him and they're like, huh, I wonder where the pilot went. There's just this kid.
I want to come back to that in a second. There's also the moment of Oliver asking, how did this happen? And Uso can't really explain. It just happened.
One thing led to another.
And Oliver's whole little speech before he realizes who it is that's piloting the Victory about, like, I told you, if you're trying to travel covertly, you can't be hopping around through the woods like this. It feels very much like they are sometimes holding him to the standards of an adult pilot and sometimes trying to, like, train him to those standards. And it's absolutely not there yet.
Well, Oliver seems to be trying to hold him to that standard. Oliver, who is a relative newcomer to the group, doesn't know the history. Just like when he comes onto the scene in this episode, he doesn't know what has led to this rather chaotic situation. He hasn't been there for all of the moments when Uso had to get into the Victory and pulled out some desperate salvation move at the last moment. How do we feel about Oliver at this point?
Mostly positive, I think. He is, like, flying well. When the boots of the Victory get too damaged, he swaps parts with Uso because he knows better for Uso to be in the Victory than for him to have the boots part on his own core fighter.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, it felt like the kind of stuff he was scolding Uso about is stuff that Uso needs to internalize to stay safe. Like, it didn't feel unreasonable to be like, okay, you really need to get better at this covert traveling thing. I don't think he was drawn as handsomely in this episode as he was in the previous one. I think he was more handsome before. I don't know what happened.
I find myself turning against him. I don't like the way he has displaced Marbet. Because his role in this episode is something that Marbet could have done and would have done before his introduction. And it's particularly insidious because, like, according to the sort of narrative architecture and logic of the story up until this point, it has been necessary for Marbet to be inadequate to the tasks in front of her, because that's what makes it necessary for Uso to get into the Gundam. And he has to do that because of the way the story is constructed. Now that Uso is actually committed to piloting for the League Militaire is the point in the story at which Marbet could begin to show some real skill and competency. Now that Uso no longer needs to be forced into the Victory, Marbet can go out there and do cool stuff. And yet, right at that moment, Oliver shows up. And Oliver, at least in this episode, is the secondary pilot.
My brother in Gundam, Marbet's leg wound needs to be allowed to heal finally. They cannot keep putting her in core fighters. She keeps tearing open her stitches. I understand your concern, but I think it's too early.
You know I don't do well with new people.
We gotta wait and see what they do with Marbet. I hope it's gonna be awesome. If it's not, I'll be disappointed right alongside you. Two other things related to Uso and the piloting. Seeing Chronicle pilot the Victory just really hammers home how, like, Uso is naturally talented, but what an experienced pilot can do with this machinery is wild.
And it's very funny, the contrast between him appreciating the design and the craftsmanship and the power of the Victory Gundam, and then immediately being like, but it's so poorly maintained. The gun doesn't even work.
Earlier, you mentioned that conflict between Uso being treated more as an adult pilot by his allies at the same time that these other people can't believe that he could possibly be the pilot. But that's because it would hurt their egos to acknowledge that they've been getting trounced by a 12-year-old.
That does seem to be the only justification for Chronicle not working it out. Given all of the flashbacks in this episode to, like, when Uso climbed into his cockpit and stole the Shaco from him, and he knows that it's Uso who did it, because later he does identify the jacket and, like, he can tell that the person who fought him in the cockpit is the same person who was piloting the Shaco. So Chronicle has, like, no excuse for not figuring this out faster.
I did love his moody flashback of, like, the most humiliating experience of my career.
You know, thinking of that, maybe the photograph of Shakti, Maria, and Chronicle wasn't actually taken in Casarelia. Because if it was, and Chronicle was, like, a teenager at the time, you would think he would remember this place, but he doesn't seem to. He seems to only know it as this spot where I encountered humiliations.
What you're saying makes sense, but this show so far has already left out a lot of explanatory information that apparently is in the books, and so for all we know, he has long reminiscences about Casarelia when he is flying around in the book that just got left completely out of the show.
Or maybe when he joined the Yellow Jackets, they beamed him over the head with a stick and he forgot everything before that.
Maybe it was called something else a decade ago and he doesn't realize it's the same place. Maybe that's not Chronicle, but like an uncle or...
Maybe it's his body double, Chronicle 2.
Somebody who looks a whole lot like him but isn't him and is older. And... I mean, not without precedent in the history of human warfare, but certainly not typical of the last 120, probably more, years. Does Chronicle just bring Katajina with him everywhere?
She is his emotional support captive.
With no, like, restraints or anything. Like, she just gets to listen to everything that everybody talks about and walk around freely and...
Well, you see, she has become convinced that the methods of the men on the Kamion are going to doom Earth to eternal hopelessness, and so she's studying the methods of Zanskar in the company of this man. That's a very compelling and believable story.
Okay, hang on. You're jumping ahead a little.
You brought up Katajina.
I know.
And what she's doing with Chronicle.
While they're flying, she thanks him for taking her to see her home. So did they stop in Uig, or... did she lie and say that she's from Casarelia to get him to come here? Like, what?
I do not know. I was thinking about this a lot, too. Katajina is definitely lying at several points in this episode because the things that she says to different people are contradictory. We don't know if she's really spying, as she tells Odello. We don't know if she's actually convinced that the League Militaire methods are wrong and that Zanskar may offer a better way forward. Her statements cannot be trusted. At one point, she tells Odello and company that coming here was Chronicle's idea alone. Earlier in the episode, she thanks Chronicle for taking her to visit her home. What exactly Katajina is after here is very unclear. And this episode, interestingly, there are a bunch of moments where we get, like, close-ups of Katajina's face at moments when it seems like there's something more going on than is immediately apparent on the surface. I think because of the show's production limitations, because of some of the issues with the animation, these close-up shots maybe don't convey as much about her internal world as they are meant to. I think there's a close-up on her face after the report of smoke coming up from Casarelia, and it's clear that she's thinking something about it that she's not saying, but what? In another moment, when Uso challenges her and before she responds with her comment about the old man on the cameo and eternal hopelessness, she pauses a weirdly long amount of time, like she's trying to thread a conversational needle.
When she first arrives at the cabin and sees Shakti, if she were trying to keep information from Chronicle, she shouldn't have asked, "Where is everybody? Where are the others?" She's immediately tipped that there are other people she would have expected to see with this girl. At the same time, when she says to Shakti, "This is the guy who saved you in the attack on the factory," I do think she's trying to make Shakti less afraid.
Though I'm not sure at that point if Chronicle had recognized Shakti, so it's really just outing Shakti as having been in the factory.
I was very frustrated by Katajina's thing about the methods of the old man on the camion, because it's really not clear what she's referring to. I feel like, you know, if I'm generous, she is probably referring to some known to the people in the story, but not yet explained to us, the audience, differences in either like the stated political goals of these two groups, or perhaps even with their modes of governance. Like, we know the League Militaire has this kind of dispersed control, like their guerrilla force, they don't have as much centralized control. And then we know Zanskar is a monarchic empire.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe she's one of those people being like, democracy is just so inefficient. I really think we need fascism, guys.
If I were to go purely off of things that Katajina has said in the course of the show and what we've seen from the respective sides, it seems like the methods of the League Militaire that she is criticizing are trying to defend the people of Earth, and the methods of the Zanskar Empire are more or less indiscriminate killing. And she does seem to be in favor of the indiscriminate killing of Earthnoids, which is, like, not a great political philosophy, but she is a traumatized teenager.
She then goes on to say something about how, like, we'll never advance if we follow the way that the League Militaire does things, or the League Militaire's goals. And I came back to that environmentalism thread that has been running through things so far, and one of the core conflicts that environmentalists have run into for as long as we have been trying to steward our environment is, oh, but your protecting XYZ environmental thing stands in the way of progress. We need to extract those resources from the earth so that we can have this new technology or this new factory or these new goods. We have to exploit the earth to advance humanity. And this idea that environmentalism is backward or anti-technology in some way.
But in Gundam, that debate is more problematic, which is to say it's more complex. Often in Gundam, when people talk about advancing, they mean the spiritual advancement of the human species towards a state of being that is beyond conflict and that exists in harmony with our natural environment. But how to get there is the big question. Everybody who gets really into, like, new type theory or the problems of humanity at large kind of agrees that that's the goal, but how to get there is the question. And in focusing on the question of methods, Katajina really emphasizes that issue of how. Very often, characters in Gundam, villains in Gundam, decide that the way to get there is to kill a lot of people. Basically, to kill everybody who is not sufficiently advanced, or to kill enough people to force everybody out into space where, by some kind of semi-magical process, everyone will become advanced. That in this case, advancement is not the advancement of science, but the advancement of spirit, and is compatible with, rather than in opposition to, that environmentalism.
I'd be more likely to think that that was what she was talking about if we hadn't actually heard an explicitly stated reverse argument from the League Militaire people in previous episodes, where they explicitly state Zanskar is coming here to exploit and mess up the Earth.
But that's their perspective.
Sure.
And I think this debate is encapsulated within this episode in the presentation of Casarelia, which I think I referred to it before as a kind of Garden of Eden for the characters, as a idealized homeland to which they will not be able to return. Here, Uso, at the end of the episode, says, "We need to leave. We can't come back here again." But it's also that in the environmental sense. Look at how lush and beautiful it is. Look at how the people of Casarelia live in rustic harmony with their environment. Casarelia is a place, and I'm dipping into the novels here again, but Casarelia is a place where active reforestation efforts by humans living in the area have helped to begin the process of regenerating the earth.
Okay, we're going to have to touch on that again with my research piece because lots of weird connections in there.
But then also look at the way Zanskar acts in this episode. We've noted how they frequently destroy large swaths of the natural environment, seemingly without a care.
In testing the beam saber on the Victory, Chronicle cuts down this massive, like, old-growth tree.
Yeah, he does, like, a classic Kesagiri cut. He's doing the, like, Tameshigiri sword cutting practice that is sort of the traditional way to test a blade. But yeah, he downs a large and healthy tree. Also, when he initially lands, he just parks his helicopter on top of a field of crops. There is plenty of open space around Casarelia. He didn't have to park in the middle of their crops. He just did because he doesn't care or doesn't even notice.
Last couple of points about Katagina. You know, she stops Odello from shooting Chronicle, which I guess is necessary if she really wants to be like a double agent, if she really wants to embed herself in Zanskar to get them information. But
do you think she really wants to do that?
I don't know.
What do you think?
I think that is a comforting thing to tell herself because life with Chronicle is more comfortable than life with the League Militaire was.
And he's very handsome and romantic.
Because unless she included some of what she's already heard in that letter for Uso, she hasn't given them anything. And I can't really believe that she hasn't heard anything worth sharing. I mean, I get that she can't or wouldn't want to stay in sort of a Zanskar without Chronicle, because he's been the one protecting her from being attacked. So no, the guys tied up in the cabin wouldn't know that she could have saved Chronicle and didn't, but she doesn't want to be in their custody. So here we are.
The similarity of this scene to the one in Char's counterattack, when Amuro almost shoots Char only for Quest to interpose herself and shove the gun out of the way, is remarkable.
And for all of her yelling at people for putting Uso in a mobile suit, her saving Chronicle puts Uso in danger. And then the fact that she's in the mobile suit with Chronicle means Uso doesn't want to shoot it down.
No, she likes mobile suits now. Like, she caught the bug. She saw a Tom Liat. She is fully committed.
At least up until now, she's done more harm than good. I do wonder who will break first. Will Odello tell Uso, oh, Katagina said she's spying? Or will Shakti give him the letter, which so far she has neglected to tell him about?
I super don't think it will matter to Uso either way. I mean, I don't know what's in the letter. There are some things that she might write there that I guess could sway him. But like, when he gets mad at her for being with Zanskar, he is 80% mad at her for being with Chronicle, only 20% mad at her for being with the enemy.
When Chronicle offers her a ride, she says yes, even though she turned down his offers of rides multiple times.
Right. Uso is having a little jealousy.
Well, yes. His crying in the cockpit towards the end of the episode is absolutely heartbreak, more than anything else. He is heartbroken to learn that Katagina is not, you know, tied up in a dungeon somewhere. She is willingly keeping company with Chronicle. And like every other moment of fear or sadness, he keeps it to himself. He doesn't let anybody see him crying like that. He waits until he can pull himself together. He's not his usual chipper self when he leaves the cockpit. He does seem very serious, but he continues to hide his feelings in the way that he has done for basically the whole show. Now, that last exchange with Uso and Shakti about the willow herb plant, we're going to talk about actually as part of the research. But I do want to circle back to the beginning for a quick moment, which is just that I really thought that Farrah Griffin was in a lot more trouble than apparently she is. I thought she was like almost a prisoner being sent to trial kind of a thing. But no, she's clearly in command of this mission. She's in the flagship.
She is enough of a professional that they trust her to essentially lead her own mission to return to her own trial and presumably her own execution. Like, she has that bit about, oh, now that he's stolen the victory, maybe Chronicle will save me from the guillotine. Like, she knows, in all likelihood, she's going to die. Unless she has some kind of a plan. She seems like the kind of person who might have a scheme.
She might.
But she is 100% sleeping with that pilot, right?
Oh yeah, he is definitely her lover. Which, sketchy, she's his commanding officer.
I would say that that is probably the least of the ethical abuses that Fire Griffin has committed.
That's probably true. I also have to share with all of you a phrase that popped into my head and is now going to be stuck there forever. So now you all get to have it stuck in your brains forever too, and that is wine mom Farrah Griffin. She's constantly got a glass of wine in her hand.
You know, I don't remember her drinking in any of the prior episodes, so maybe this is what she's doing now that she thinks she's going to die.
Maybe it's a Mandela effect thing. I could have sworn other times that she's been on this mobile armor, she's been drinking wine.
The Recarl comes with one of those built-in little drink fridges.
She keeps a case of wine there for emergencies, and by emergencies, I mean when she's just hanging out there.
The backseat is all, like, authentic Corinthian leather. She had this one kitted out for luxury use. Oh, gosh. It's her, like, love mobile.
Shall we move on to the research and Willow Herb?
One brief moment to talk more about mobile suit design.
Okay.
The Zolocopter has two seats in a tandem configuration. What happens to that second seat when it transforms into a mobile suit?
Does it swing around underneath?
I don't know. All I know is that when they're leaving, Katagina is sitting on Chronicle's lap. There doesn't seem to be a designated seat for her. All right, now I'm ready to talk about flowers. So without further introduction, Nina's research on Willow Herb.
Willow herb can refer to any number of dozens of species belonging to the genus Epilobium or Caminarian, and in English is also called fireweed. They are herbaceous flowering plants, most common in temperate and subarctic or subantarctic climates. They can grow in subtropical or tropical climates, but they're only found in cooler environments, so like at high altitude. It's very, quote, quick to carpet large swaths of ground, to the point of being invasive or driving out other plant species. And one potential reason it's called fireweed is that it springs up in areas that have been cleared by forest fires. And other fires, because according to Wikipedia, it used to spring up in London bomb sites during World War II.
There is a, I was going to say urban legend, but urban legend is exactly the wrong word for this. There is a rural legend, old wives' tale, that fireweed seeds need the fire to, like, crack the seed pods open. I don't think that's true.
It's not.
Thank you for... thank you. It's just that it's a pioneer species that needs, like, wide-open swaths of land in order to be able to grow up. And so fires create those wide-open swaths.
The other potential reason for the name is the color, which can range vivid magenta to light pink to scarlet. I'll include a couple of pictures in the show notes if I can find good ones. The huge fields of bright pink are really striking. I've mentioned on the podcast before that I lived in Alaska when I was very young. Fireweed grows all over the place in Alaska and is one of the very pretty sights in the summertime. And you'll just see these huge fields of bright, bright pink. Though it is very much a wildflower, some varieties are grown as garden plants, and willow herb is an important food for a lot of butterfly and moth species. It's also used as an herbal remedy and a sweetener. Another childhood memory, I remember having fireweed syrup on pancakes. In Japan, it's called yanagi-ran, which combines the kanji for yanagi, or willow, because of the shape of its leaves, with the kanji for ran, or orchid, because of the shape of its flowers. It's found in Honshu and Hokkaido, with several specific locations famous for their yanagi-ran blooms. One such location is Mount Kirigamine, a volcano in Nagano Prefecture. In fact, the famous author and screenwriter Tanaka Sumie, who, incidentally, did some writing for anime as well, paired the two, the mountain and the flower, in her 1980 essay collection, Hana no Hyaku Meizan, which pairs each of 100 famous mountains with a flower. The book is quite famous, having won the Yomiuri Literary Award in the essay travel category the year it was published. As for Mount Kirigamine itself, it has a series of peaks surrounded by grasslands, wetlands, and some slowly recovering forests. It used to be very forested. For hundreds of years, people went there to get wood. Now, much of the area has been turned into a nature preserve or designated natural treasure, and so slowly those forests are now recovering. What feels like a second bit of incredible serendipity, or perhaps not, Mount Kirigamine is described as the birthplace of Japanese gliders. They have been flown there since the Taisho era. It has a glider museum, and it remains a popular location to fly gliders. In her essay about Mount Kirigamine and Yanagiran, Tanaka describes the flower as the color of fire, and emphasizes that it's a late summer bloom there, that the cool akikaze, or autumn winds, have started blowing when the Yanagiran are at their most profuse.
Yeah, I understand that Yanagiran only bloom, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, in like July and August. So I don't know when victory is supposed to take place, but we can be fairly confident that this episode takes place in July or August.
According to some Japanese websites on Hanakotoba, or the language of flowers, which, of course, none of these websites have any sources, Yanagiran symbolize concentration, focus, and single-mindedness. Since they spring up after fire, or bombings, there's a plausible association with destruction and rebirth. And the tide of late summer could symbolize hard times coming, with autumn and winter fast approaching, that kind of thing. In the show, this exchange between Uso and Shakti seems to indicate that Willow Herb has some kind of significance or importance to Uso and his family. And there are multiple shots, once you're looking for it, in the episode where you can see the pink flowers in the background. There's one from above one of the Zolo, and you see these streaks of pink in front of the cabin. When Chronicle and Katajina walk up to the cabin, they walk through a field of these pink flowers. Whether it grows wild in the valley or whether Uso's family planted it, there's clearly some kind of importance or connection for them personally. Per the subtitles, Uso says, "If we leave Willow Herb for her, she'll find us wherever we go." And I kept thinking about my musings last week that Uso and Shakti's parents might have been involved in the invasion somehow, whether supporting it or fighting it. And I can imagine a scene of Uso's mother showing him this sprig of willow herb and explaining that it symbolizes focus or single-mindedness, explaining that in pursuit of an important goal, she has to go away and leave him behind. And then them leaving the willow herb for her would make this a similar message. Sorry, we're not here waiting for you where you left us. We had our own goal that we had to go pursue. Sidebar, it's very interesting that they don't mention any of the other parents, only Uso's mother. A sweeter version might play out similarly, but with the parents forced to leave by some circumstance, and the willow herb symbolizing Uso's mother's intention to single-mindedly do everything she can to return as soon as possible. Uso now is also being forced away from home by circumstances. He doesn't really want to go. And so again, leaving the willow herb as an expression of his intent to do everything he can to come back. But given that this is Tomino, I think that first one is more likely. This is all just me imagining scenes that may or may not exist.
But what I think, in fact, has happened here is that we have been misled by the English translation. The verb that has been translated as to leave is, I think, sakaseru, which actually doesn't mean to leave behind. It means to make bloom. So I think what Uso is saying here is actually, if we plant fireweed wherever we go, then they'll be able to follow us. They'll follow the trail of breadcrumbs. Which becomes extremely dark when you think about the connotations of fireweed as something that grows up in the aftermath of a battle. Because Usto is saying, wherever we go, we'll always be fighting, and we can leave fireweed behind in the blasted craters left behind by our battles.
It also just occurred to me, I don't know if either of Usto's parents are into parachuting and gliding like he is, but the fireweed in front of their house could have been a good visual landmark for him to, like, know where home was when he's high up in the sky. Just look for this bright patch of pink that we planted, you know? And so there is this sense of using it to guide you home, assuming that it's not just endemic to the valley, that they planted what's there. Because if it's endemic to the valley, that's no help whatsoever.
Now, it does, I mean, it does look like it's been planted in specific plots.
It does, yeah.
You'll remember Shakti starts crying only after Usto says the line about leaving the fireweed behind. And I think it's because if you know everything we just told you, that line from Usto does mean, like, come on, Shakti, we have to go, and there's only going to be more fighting in our future.
And it's going to be a long time before we can come back. Because even if it's the early part of the plant season, right? Even if he's being figurative and they're not actually going to plant fireweed everywhere they go, he just expects it will spring up. It takes plants time to grow, and the bloom season is going to be over in at most like a month and a half, and then it won't bloom again until next summer. Like, the implication is that they are going to be gone a long time.
How much do you think the average Tokyo child knows about the properties of fireweed? Or willow herb?
Oh, probably nothing. You know, I was not certain about the connection between that book, even though it was a very famous book, and some of the details in this show, until you mentioned the bit about the woods also, and I was like, okay, hang on. That's like too many coincidences. And I will confess, I did not look through Tanaka Sumie's entire list of anime credits, but it is entirely possible that she worked on a project with someone who was on the writing team for Victory. She did a lot of screenplays and a lot of anime scripts and stuff. Also, if you are curious about the book, it's available on the Bookwalker app. I was able to download it the other day, and it's not expensive. Next time on episode 10.10, In the Ruin of This Beautiful Place, we research and discuss episode 10 of Victory Gundam and Karaoke Code. Look, we've all done foolish things for the sake of a cute girl who is also a little bit mean. The hardest a kid has ever had to work to steal the Gundam. A ladies' man. Bodacious space pilots. Usto is an anxious overthinker, and I have never related to a Gundam protagonist more. A redheaded One-san type appears. Right thinking, right action, but the timing stinks. Even Dupre has a heart. And a Gundam rite of passage. Please listen to it.
Mobile Suit Breakdown is written, recorded, and produced by us, Tom and Nina, in scenic New York City, within the ancestral and unceded land of the Lenape people, and made possible by listeners like you. The opening track is Wasp by Misha Dioxin. The closing music is Long Way Home by Spinning Ratio. The recap music is Slow by Lloyd Rogers. You can find links to the sources for our research, the music used in the episode, additional information about the Lenape people, and more in the show notes on our website, GundamPodcast.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email hosts@GundamPodcast.com or look for links to our social media accounts on our website. And if you would like to support the show, please share us with your friends, leave a nice review wherever you listen to podcasts, or support us financially at GundamPodcast.com/Patreon. You can find links and more ways to help out at GundamPodcast.com/support. Thank you for listening. The Gundam fandom has been corrupted by wrong opinions, and the only way to purify ourselves is by exposing them to the light of day. And yet, from time to time, someone manages to have a correct opinion about Gundam. I know, I'm as surprised as you are. But Fancy Wookie observed that the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good girl and a herd of out-of-control sheep. You know, it's like the old rhyme says, "Bah, bah, earth sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir. Now drop the gun or we'll ram you like a bull." I grew up in a pretty wildernessy area, and there was a fair amount of what we might call illegal agriculture going on. She still can't tell them apart, though.
Well, but the Victory doesn't have beam rotors,
that's true.
I forget to write down the funny joke I came up with yesterday.
Oh, no. Has there been a single opening as catchy as the first Gundam opening?
I'm sure a lot of people would say Anime Genai, but no.
No. Anime Genai is great, but as with First Gundam as a whole, there's just something special about it that none of the sequels have ever been able to recapture. It might not be my favorite, but I purely admit that there is something absolutely uniquely special about it.
Oh, that's funny, huh? Test, test. The right ear on this headset is dead.
Oh, you must have gotten one of the ones that's broken.
We can afford to have ones that are decent.
We can afford to have working headphones.
That aren't falling apart, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I was like, oh gosh, are my ears all plugged up? And I'm like, oh no, it's broken.
Yeah, headphones. They're old and busted. Now drop that gun, or we'll put you in a hole. Which of those is better?
I think ram you like a bull, because it rhymes.
Hole also rhymes with wool. I'll go with the first one. You liked it better, which is the only thing I care about.